Greg, I want to thank you so much for making this special interview happen. Greg Masters, everyone, is the co-host of Health Unabashed. He's also the host of Pop Health Week. Greg, many people may not know, is actually a very active public health professional. He's working very closely in the California region. And I'm very fortunate to have his guidance and his help as executive producer of Health Unabashed. Greg, as always, thank you so much for everything you're doing for us. We're speaking to you from the floor of HIMSS. First of all, I've been to many, many HIMSS meetings. I have to say, this might be among the biggest HIMSS meetings that we've had in the last, I'd say close to a decade. This floor, the exhibit floor, is packed wall to wall to wall. And it's amazing that we're broadcasting live right from the exhibit floor itself. We have a very special guest. In some ways, Philip Brady, Philip Bradley, I wanted to make sure I got that right. Philip Bradley is really one of the, I'd say he's the central nervous system of HIMSS in many respects. Now, he's chuckling at this, but Phil, as he prefers to be called, actually is the person who comes from the health information business, really as a chief technology officer. He's been in Houston for more than two decades, working in health systems. There are numerous health systems, including Ascension, which is really a major health force in this country. And he's worked in health systems large and small. He's tasked of supervising a team of about 40 professionals. That includes IT folks and people interfacing with the health systems around the United States to really take a look at probably one of the biggest opportunities in health today, one of the biggest challenges in health today, which is, of course, the EMR. And Phil, I want to get a little more background on this because you've been scouring the country looking at what works and what doesn't work for health systems. Not everybody has sort of a health IT department to the size of HIMSS. I mean, many hospital systems, of course, really, they just don't have the infrastructure to have someone like yourself and your team on staff. So first, I wanted to get a little bit background of the types of health systems you're interfacing with, just so the listeners can get a sense of the landscape you cover.
Okay. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. The organizations that we interface with are all size and shapes, and they're not just in the U.S. They're global, and I primarily focus in the Americas, but I've been elsewhere as well. From very large organizations that have all the staff that they need to very small organizations that struggle with staffing. Not that they're small organizations financially, but they're in a market that may struggle with staffing, technical staff. So while we're out there from the IT side, from the clinical informatics side, you know, how do they get these individuals and how do they shore up the gaps that the open positions create? It's one of the biggest challenges that we see. And then how do we see them start leveraging the technologies, the software? You know, the software is all pretty good stuff, even though it gets beat up in the market quite a bit. If you really look at it, what you see is organizations that took it out of the box and implemented it without really adjusting the people and process side of it. You know, we say that a lot in this industry. People, process, and technology is very, very true. And it's important that we understand the needs and the workflow of the clinicians, because if we don't do that well, clinicians have a way of finding the path of least resistant to take care
Absolutely.
Of patients.
You know, we had on the program last year Dr. Alana Yurkovich from Stanford, and she's I think she is tri-certified as an internal medicine, hematology, and oncology. She wrote a best-selling book, which I adore, I recommend to our listeners, called Fragmented. And she talks about the fact that the EMR doesn't read like a novel, like a book. It's snippets of information dumped in, often repetitive, and it's just unwieldy. And you've been in that hospital system. You know, in our conversation before the show, you said something I thought so insightful. I just want to give you credit for it and let everybody know. You talked about the fact that often often technology, information technology, the EMR, for instance, it's created by people who know information or structure or information technology. It's not really designed for the clinicians or the nurses, the physician staff, and so forth. It's designed for the technology staff in some regards. And you know, I just wanted to get your sense of someone who is, obviously you've been a chief technology officer. In many ways, you serve that role within HIMSS. And you know, at the same time, you have stepped back and you have that sensitivity about the users of the system, the clinicians, the health providers. What's your thought? I mean, you know, obviously we don't want to point fingers here, but we do want to understand the landscape that medical professionals face that you and HIMSS are trying to address.
I think that perspective comes from 7 years of assessing organizations against their EMR capabilities, against our MRAM adoption model, OMRAM, now CCOM, and really getting an insight. And I actually have a lecture that I do, and I titled it Don't Blame IT. And I don't say that just for the punchline. I mean it because IT was asked, as we go back through history, IT was asked to automate books, general ledger, inventory control, finance, accounts payable. Those are all books that were automated. And when it comes to the EMR, we try to automate the chart. And that, there's a struggle. You know, so don't blame IT for it, because if you hand it to IT and they install it, that's what you're going to get. Instead, it needs to be clinically driven. IT is a critical component of it, making sure the system is capable of what the organization expects, both technically and functionally, workflow. But if the clinicians don't build it, sign off on it, it's going to be a struggle to get them to adopt it. And if you have low adoption, you're very likely to have very poor outcomes from your investments.
Now, that's very important. You know, I'm often taken with the fact that when I speak to either newly minted physicians or even veterans in the field of medicine who are part of major academic medical centers, and I ask them the basic question, how much training do you get on technology today? I'm talking about the simple things, first of all, wearables, for instance, remote patient monitoring technologies, and then we move up the line to something that's essential to the day-to-day patient care, which is the EMR, the electronic medical record. Their answer is very candid. We in medical school, we get little to no training, maybe a few hours at best. But when we take a look at how fundamental it is that information guides medical decision-making, the reality is that's an on-the-job training environment. And then we're dealing with, well, technology. We talk about health disparities. Medicine is facing technological disparities. And it's not just seniors who might be, or people don't have access to good technology. It's the medical practitioner as well. My wife recently was speaking to a doctor and about her shoulder, and she needed pain management. She said, "Do you have someone you recommend?" And this world-class surgeon said, I don't have anyone. Look it up in the yellow pages, right? The yellow pages. Now, I don't know when the last time I saw a yellow pages, but this is a very skilled, well-known, the surgeon of the surgeons, so to speak, and he's recommending the yellow pages. So we have an indicator that the skill of the medical practitioner and their tech savvy don't necessarily align. How do you and your team account for that?
We look in and help organizations assess where is the gap, what causes the gap of physician frustration, productivity. You know, I'm tired of being here until 7 p.m. doing my notes. If I feel like I've been hired to do key punch operations. And the difference that we see is the level of physician training when the doc comes on board. The best example is elbow support, where you have someone that understands the system and is a practicing physician likely, or a PA, and can answer the questions more than push this button and then push that button and then push that one. And those come up the learning curve pretty quickly. that is an expensive means of training if you look at it strictly from the cost as while you're doing it. Look at it over time. It's much less expensive than let me show you a PowerPoint and show you click this button and then that button. And when the doc has a question, they don't know where to go. You know, and then it comes to support. When a physician asks the question, how do I change this order, for example, and they call the help desk and you have an IT help desk person on the other end of the call, that's not a very good interaction.
Right.
You know, they don't want to know the answer tomorrow within 24 hours, which might be the IT SLA.
Generally, they need to know right then and there.
I need to know right now.
Right.
Otherwise, I'm just going to find another way to do this and move on. And organizations have to take into mind, how many interruptions are we putting in front of the doc? You know, doctors have a lot on their mind, and now they have to document, I want to do these four things for the patient before I move on. And a poorly designed system keeps popping up unnecessary alerts, you know, and you start getting into alert fatigue or asking for information isn't relevant to that patient. So it causes interruption in their train of thought. And that's where a lot of the frustration comes from. You know, if you're going to interrupt a physician, make it actionable. Make it something that's meaningful for them that will change behavior. If it doesn't change your behavior, why do it?
Right.
Right. And make it better. Because otherwise you can get into.
I wanted to explore with you, you know, before I arrived at HIMSS, I saw a lot of social media posts that said, first of all, why does HIMSS have to hold its meeting on the heels of Vive, which was 2 weeks earlier? And, you know, I tweeted back at these people, or I guess posted back. I said, well, a meeting the size of HIMSS, which is 35,000 people plus, is scheduled at a location years in advance. Vive is a relatively new organization, and it's a meeting. And this is the kicker, I think, which is the key factor, which leads to your position, that Vive is a dynamic meeting of about 8,000 people, very important, exciting, edgy topics. HIMSS is a society, it's a professional society of 125,000 members, of which a great chunk of that community does come to this annual global gathering. You also have ministers of state, ministers of health departments from various countries here with their entourage and so forth. This is a diplomatic setting. It's sort of like the Davos of health information. I mean, no escaping it. And your role speaks to this. So organizations like Vive are not societies. They are communities that gather for that exciting meeting. You're working 365 days a year on problems that the health professional and the health community face. I know that you personally, your team, have been working closely with information giant Oracle. You received from Oracle a very compelling program that they felt that HIMSS would be better suited to dissect and build for the health community. And you've been spending some time doing that. And now you and your team are sort of rolling that product out to health systems. I'd like to hear about the genesis of that. You know, that's a dynamic move on Oracle's part to say, we can't bring this to the finish line, but certainly HIMSS could. You take it on, and we appreciate that. Good luck. And now you've been responsible with this team of 40 of dissecting, rebuilding, listening. I'd love to hear about your going out to the market, speaking to health professionals, getting this amazing Oracle product, rebuilding it, and then offering it back out to the system.
This is actually a Cisco product.
Cisco, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Cisco product. Cisco created an infrastructure model back in 2015 in their Australian, New Zealand market. And while it was successful, they saw that there was limited use, and the organization saw it more as a sales tool than an adoption model. So they approached us if we would consider turning that into one of our adoption models like MRAM. We looked at it. We saw that there was value there, but with the understanding that the first thing we had to do was – D-Cisco eyes it. We had to take all the stickers off. Anything that looked like acronyms that looked like Cisco had to be removed and had to be neutralized because we're vendor agnostic. And then we put together a model that matched our MRAM, and it's been in the market for since 2018. And we've had globally right at 300 organizations use that. That's quite a few. And so we've gathered a lot of data. We see where the struggles are, both in the market as they struggle with infrastructure, particularly now as it's very dynamic and which way to go. We needed to modernize it, to step a little ways from asking a technical question like, you know, is it a two-tier or three-tier network design? You know, frankly, no one outside of IT cares. You know, they are just looking for performance. They're looking for consistency and stability and the organization meeting a service objective. So what we've created is a tool that has the IT service measures that are still in place, cybersecurity being very important, IT management and control, where you have, you look at the age of infrastructure, look at the management, the change management, processes that are in place, and getting into adoption. We see organizations in my tours of other facilities where technologies are purchased, and the best example I can use is mobile carts. They're expensive, they're high maintenance, and when I go through an organization, I see a mobile cart, it's plugged into power and it's plugged into a data port. It's not really a mobile cart any longer. So that organization has invested in that technology, but they're not leveraging the investment at all. It's a desk, and you can buy a cheaper desk. So the adoption component makes sure that the organization understands what will work before they purchase it. You know, and we hear that it drops network connectivity when I roll it around, or it's too big. You know, the battery doesn't last long enough. A lot of reasons. To understand, is this piece going to work? Let the clinicians actually play with it in a lab setting that simulates where they're going to be, and actually use it in the workflow, and then say, let them say, yes, this will work, and then you purchase it, and then be able to measure, is our adoption where we expected it to be? If we're lagging behind, what can we do to adjust it? Do you have the data in place? Because we think that if you do the cybersecurity and IT performance well, and you have high levels of adoption of those technologies, then you're going to start realizing the outcomes. And that's the fourth focus area is, you've invested all this money in these technologies. What are you expecting to get out of it? And we want the organizations to stop thinking about, we want to upgrade the Wi-Fi because of technical reasons. There are always good technical reasons. Instead, think of it as, we want to upgrade the Wi-Fi because we want to do point of collection for specimens. And here's all the operational benefits that we expect to see from that technology investment, software, workflow investment, and then measure, are we getting there? And we expect them to show us case studies when we come in and do an assessment of the organization. It's a validation that shows us examples of, we expect that these KPIs to be adjusted, improved on, and then actually see it within 12 months of data at least, to see that it's actually working. But more importantly, that executives have the data to see, we're ahead of schedule or we're falling behind. What can we do to adjust? So you actually take a look at it.
And what are some of the unique advantages for the health system of turning to HIMSS and saying, look, let's build in your product into our system? Obviously, it's compatible with other systems that they're using. Is that correct?
Yeah.
We all know the 500-pound sort of gorilla of EMRs is obviously here. They probably have one of the biggest footprints on this meeting. It's Epic, of course. So what you've built has had to be compatible to Epic. Is that?
Well, we work very closely with them. They're a partner of ours. And they actually build our stage 6 capabilities. Our models go from 0 to 7. They build stage 6 into their go-live plans. So you're not left in what I call the danger zone. We work with them closely. They understand our models very, very well. And they build in those capabilities. Stage 7 is achieved over time. you know, that's an adoption score. Six is you have everything in place. Seven is the adoption level going forward. And so we work with them and other vendors as well to make sure, because what we want to avoid is the organization that installs a new EMR and they're spending more money than they've ever spent before. And the clinician frustration is higher than ever before.
Oh, of course.
So how does a CEO get out of that model, that scenario? And what we see is at stage 4 and 5 in our adoption models, you have invested in a lot of the technology you need, but you're not using it very well. So use our adoption models to show you where you are today and give that CEO a roadmap to safety. Let's get you up to stage 6. You know, you're currently at stage 4. Here's all the reasons why. This is what you need to do to get to stage 5 and then the next step to stage 6.
What's the size of the largest systems you're working with on this product and the smallest ones?
Let's start with the smallest because I find them fascinating. We have seen FQHCs use the model, fully hosted, outsourced, cloud-based, use the model and achieve stage 7. We've seen a lot of community centers use those as well. And on the other side, we use, you know, from here in the States, nationally recognized organizations have used it. Some of the most prestigious organizations, we talked about some earlier before the show, have used it and achieved stage 7. And then when we go to other countries where you have national health, we work at that level as well. So from very small to the very large. And it isn't all just acute care, typical acute care med centers, but we also work closely with specialty areas. One of the highest usage is in mental health, but particularly in Canada, where they have acute care settings for mental health care and helping them to achieve stage 6 and 7 as well.
You know, I look at this and I'm thinking of certainly my participation in other large not-for-profit organizations like the American Heart Association when they launched their program called Get With The Guidelines, which really was a guidance to medical systems who were discharging patients who had some form of cardiovascular event. And, of course, the critical event they had dealt with, let's say it was a heart attack. They had saved the person was about to be released, but there was no sort of sense of how about their blood pressure, how about their lipid levels and so forth. So they created an information program that allowed doctors to actually take that patient's data, put it into Get With The Guidelines, and determine what's the post, sort of like the post inpatient care essential. And so it was a very early stage of, you could say, augmented intelligence meets health information to keep people alive out of the hospital system. And I always thought that had a private corporation come in and said to Columbia Presbyterian, Mount Sinai, Cedars-Sinai, we've got an amazing program for you that, since you're doing so much cardiovascular work, this is going to allow you to capture more revenue, save more lives, blah, 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 blah. If Cedars-Sinai would have just hit the off button in their heads, because it's a for-profit enterprise. HIMSS is sort of Switzerland of health information. It's a neutral professional society looking at problems within the health provider universe and coming up with essentially solutions that are forms of best practice, because you're able to sit at the table with all these different companies. And I'm amazed at that. So that's what you've done. You've sat with Cisco. You've got the program. You're speaking with tons of companies here on the exhibit floor in private meetings, you know, in their office, your office. And you've developed this product, and now it's in 300-some-odd systems. I'm just curious, because it's HIMSS, you and HIMSS, you come from the industry, the health provider industry. You are in HIMSS. HIMSS is a large 125,000-person member society. Do you feel that you immediately get sort of like placed at the table to talk to them about the product and how it helps? And I'd be curious to know, those that say, let's do this, what are maybe the two, three factors that they state where they say to you, Philip, absolutely, let's move forward with this. The CEO is on board.
Yeah. It's not as easy as you might think. A lot of times the organization is feeling like we're doing great. Well, you know, have you done an external assessment? Have you compared yourself to peers? Have you looked outside your own four walls? So sometimes you have to get through that thought that we're doing fine. But those organizations that do take it on go a couple of different ways. I've seen organizations that take the survey, you know, and the surveys go from stage zero, where you have absolutely nothing, to stage seven, the highest level. And they come in at a stage four, and they're really surprised by the score, five, maybe six. You know, we really thought we were better. You know, we have some work to do, and they take it very seriously, and they put together the project and the resources needed to close the gaps. And they do, and they work very closely with us and with our digital health partners, our DHTPs as well. And then we have the other organizations that, okay, we'll take the survey. And then they take the survey and find that they're stage four and then blame the bad result on the survey. And some of those are nationally recognized as well. And, you know, so you really need to have the right person at the table. It's not just an IT decision. This is an organization decision, quite often led by the CMIO, that wants to see improvements. We know we have gaps. We know that we can do better. I think one of the greatest things of HIMSS is not only that we're the Switzerland of healthcare, but it's the cross sharing of ideas. You know, we over at our booth, we have clients presenting, this is how we solve that problem. And they're very well attended because we're all trying to fix the same sort of problems.
Yeah. Would you say to our listeners, we're wrapping up now, unfortunately, what are the two biggest problems you're hoping to solve through this?
Tough question.
I know.
Trying to limit it down. One is, you know, let's make the most of the electronic medical record investments, whether it's a software, workflow, technology. And we would talk about it from the technology side. Too often it's still the case, well, we'll just buy better technology and that'll fix the problem. And that's not the case at all. The other that, and we haven't talked about, is the sustainability. And that's not only in the longevity for the organization, but the impact of carbon impact as well.
I'm glad you said that, by the way, environmental sustainability. I know hospitals use about 20% of the nation's power grid, though they're 5% of the physical footprint. Phil Bradley has been with us. He's really the HIMSS ambassador on all things technology, and certainly the biggest aspect of technology, the EMR. Phil, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.